Okay, and now it gives me real pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Norman Gottwald, Emeritus Professor of Biblical Studies at New York Theological Seminary and presently Adjunct Professor at the Pacific School of Religion. He's an ordained minister of the American Baptist Churches, USA. Professor Gottwald is a pioneer in the social critical study of the Hebrew Bible. His groundbreaking book, published in 1979, is The Tribes of Yahweh, a sociology of the religion of liberated Israel during the period 1250 to 1050 BC. His book argues for the origins of Israel, the Israelites, as a social revolutionary peasant movement. His most recent work is The Politics of Ancient Israel. Currently, Dr. Gottwald is a founder and board member of the Center and Library for the Bible and Social Justice, which aims to provide informed biblical resources for those committed to the study and practice of social justice in contemporary church and society. He continues to lecture worldwide in the United States, obviously, but also in such countries as England, Israel, South Africa, Brazil, Korea, etc., on the relevance of biblical society, economics, and ethics for contemporary life. His talk today is entitled Ancient Israel's Anti-Imperialist Origins, Analogies for Today, Please welcome Dr. Gottwald.
I'm very honored to be here in a territory that I, some decades ago, spent a lot of time in. There have been some changes. They all look good to me, but it still looks like the old Maine. This topic is, I think, of particular pertinence now because we've had a new infusion of biblical rhetoric into political discourse in our country. And it's all based upon often unexamined assumptions about some analogy or analogies between biblical Israel or the early church and the situation today. This kind of rhetoric is widely deplored because it tends to be very moralistic, either in dismissive name-calling, you know, you're a Pharaoh, you're a Jezebel, you're a Nebuchadnezzar, you're a Judas, or it's self-promoting moral posturing. You know, you're as wise as Solomon, or even you're following in the footsteps of Jesus or Paul. Not only do we find this singling out of particular personalities, but also the identification of the nation as the new Israel or the people of God when stated theologically. And if you don't happen to recognize that, and in a moment I'll explain why you may or may not, the secularized versions of that, Manifest Destiny, Melting Pot, The American Dream, Guardian of the Free World, The Last Best Hope of Earth, and the one I hear a lot of today, The Greatest Nation on Earth, especially from people who've never been in any other nation. So couldn't we just clear the air of political discourse by simply abolishing such analogies altogether? Well, it wouldn't work, because in reality, analogy is a basic procedure in historical and ethical reasoning. The Protestant historical theologian Ernst Troeltsch specified that analogy is one of the fundamental components of historical consciousness. How do we understand the past? We understand it because we have the capacity to see analogies between what happens before our own eyes and events of the past. Analogy makes it possible to interpret the unknown past by the known present, or sometimes in reverse, to interpret the uncertain present by a better known past. All that sounds very shaky, And it is. The only thing you can say for it is that it's a lot less shaky than not recognizing what you're doing. Analogizing from Bible to the present was a finely crafted art of Puritan Protestantism in the 16th and 17th centuries. And England transplanted that to New England, and in the guise of biblical analogizing, this became a matter for many of deep-seated belief in national communities as being in fundamental continuity with the ancient biblical societies, especially national English-speaking communities. During the English Civil Wars, Cromwell's New Model Army was heavily recruited from dissenters of all stripes, among them the so-called Fifth Monarchy men, who stood for the kingdom of the righteous mentioned in the book of Daniel, who were destined to supplant all pagan governments. And in Christopher Fry's verse drama, A Sleep of Prisoners, captured soldiers of the New Model Army held in a church fall asleep and dream of themselves living out biblical stories. It's not exactly the greatest verse in the world, but it's quite a read. A Sleep of Prisoners by Christopher Fry. And William Blake, heretic that he was, could envision England as the New Jerusalem. In his poem based on Numbers 11:29, "Would to God that all the Lord's people were prophets. And in those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green, and was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? And was Jerusalem builded here among these dark satanic mills? Bring me my bow of burning gold. Bring me my arrows of desire. Bring me my spear, O clouds unfold. Bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land." This, I understand, has historically been the anthem or hymn of the British Labour Party. I don't know if it still is. More immediate to our own history, I mentioned the Puritan successors in the time of the Revolutionary War. Nicholas Street in 1777 preached his famous New Haven sermon, and I love the titles. I wish we used titles that full nowadays. "The American States Acting Over the Part of the Children of Israel in the Wilderness and Thereby Impeding Their Entrance into Canaan's Rest." That fills a large part of any church bulletin. And of course, in this, the faithful followers of Moses were the patriots, and the murmurers and rebels were the Tories. Or when Samuel Langdon delivered his sermon to the General Court of New Hampshire in the annual election of 1788, he was pitching for the adoption of the proposed new federal constitution of the United States, which, if New Hampshire adopted it, being the ninth state to approve, the plan would be put into effect. His title was briefer, but it's very clear. "The Republic of the Israelites, an example to the American states." Even from this brief survey, we can see that the biblical analogizing is not just a rhetorical gimmick. It has to do substantively with how you identify yourself and your membership in one or another community. Accordingly, the analogies, whether they turn out to be decorative or substantive, must be assessed in total context with respect to the way these analogies are applied and which ones we would prefer not to apply. We could sum up the principle this way: analogy is not identity. Analogy is similarity, and that also means that it is similarity amid difference. So, in what sense is the United States a new Israel or a Christian nation? It seems to me important here that this not be treated simply as a religious or theological question. I think it is important for religious folk to consider the socio-political and geopolitical aspects of these analogies. There are two key questions here. Are similar entities and processes being compared? Is there really an analogy here? And what about the behavior? Are the policies and practices observable in the two contexts comparable? If this is done, it seems to me we can develop reasonable analogies which accord with certain ethical and political principles which we may hold on some other grounds, and not simply because they seem to be exhibited in this particular analogy. So, what about the total context? I want to talk, first of all, at some length about the context of ancient Israel, because I think that's the least known, even though many of us share a common Bible. And then I want to talk about whether that's comparable to the United States, both internally, domestically, and externally in terms of the American empire. Early Israel arose as an anti-hierarchic movement, socially in its formation by tribes, and politically in opposition to tribute, taxes, military draft, state corvée. And this has been compared, I think, usefully with anthropological studies of societies that are often called regulated anarchies, as in the famous book, Tribes Without Rulers. That is, societies that managed to manage themselves without hierarchic or autocratic rule through rotation of leadership, negotiation, efforts at consensual undertakings, and so on. I have gone into some detail in trying to see this in the biblical texts that are often just seen religiously, often on some kind of premise that this was a revelation from on high, which I wouldn't try to dispute as such. I guess I would simply say, if God is behind this, God is behind it in a certain way, and that certain way we can detect through a social critical analysis. The antipathy of early Israelites to centralized political structures is exhibited in their mockery of the brutality, incompetence, and misrule of kings. One of the most striking statements of this sort is Jotham's fable in Judges 8, a fable about trees, or actually in this case really not much more than plants or shrubs, trees that set out to anoint a king over themselves. They offer kingship in succession to the olive tree, to the fig tree, and to the grapevine. All three scornfully reject the offer because they don't want to abandon their socially constructive roles as providers of food and drink. However, the unproductive bramble readily agrees to serve as king and ludicrously offers himself or herself, I don't know what the gender of this bramble was, to be the ruler, offering shade, which of course it does not possess. And the lesson of this satirically artful fable delivers is this: kings are socially and economically worse than useless. They are deluded and mad. The Song of Deborah in Judges 5 is one of the earliest texts exhibiting the fragile unity of six of the tribes that gather together to defeat an enemy army of chariots, probably under strategically favorable or tactically favorable circumstances during a rainstorm or in a position into which they have lured the chariots, which are useless in the battle. Now, the material cultural evidence from archaeology is important here because we do have, over the span of a couple of centuries prior to the development of monarchy in Israel, quite a solid picture of residency in the highlands, what would be the West Bank today, and I want to return to that issue later on. And what we see is that we have a culture here based on minimal rainfall agriculture. It's a fragile subsistence economy. Cereals, fruits, vegetables supplemented by animal husbandry. Plowing, harvesting, and food processing technologies that are very simple. Dependent mainly on wood, bone, and bronze tools, and a growing but still limited supply of iron. Cisterns caught the season rainfall, and grain was stored in rock-hewn silos. Terraced hillsides maximized land available for cultivation and water retention. Buildings were residential with little evidence of larger public structures. Trade was limited mainly to regional goods. The pottery, from our point of view, is pretty poor. And we can gather from this a profile of the seasonal cycle of rural life in that context. The mode of production in early Israel was communitarian, in contrast to the tributary mode of production practiced in Egypt and Canaan. That is, the small farmers of early Israel did not have to hand over any of their produce to some other authority, or they strove mightily not to. Israelite peasants, freed from the dominion of central government, enjoyed their agricultural and pastoral surpluses without taxation or tribute. Internally, they practiced loans in kind to assist impoverished farmers, which were offered without interest. And the prohibition on interest extended far, far into Christian history, many centuries down before finally the church gave way and said, okay, you can charge interest, because the way we run economy now, if you don't, it's not going to work. But that was a substantial and essential point to the economy of earliest Israel. There was a safety net, in other words, for everybody in the society. Priests did some things religiously. Most services were out of doors, but laity did things. When you read the early books of the Bible, laity are often doing things as much as priests. There doesn't seem to be a huge jealousy on the part of the priesthood, or they haven't as yet aspired to the power that they later had. This communitarian agriculture also was based on agricultural strategies that were favorable to the small farmer. They resisted the one-crop economies of colonial societies, and the practice in Palestine was to grow cereal in great volume and send it to Rome or Egypt, or a little later on, the wine culture. Fine wine from Israel could be developed on large vineyard estates. How did you get them? By expropriating the small farmers through excessive taxation, inflated interest on loans, and turning the former owners into tenant farmers or beggars. Israelite cultivators were at first free of such burdens on their livelihood. However, there intruded on the scene the Philistines, who were the first of a series of outside powers who had centralized government and were able to threaten the very existence of this kind of communitarian society. And so in the process, they chose a single military leader, Saul, and there began a process that I call creeping monarchism. Step after step taken that at the time, the full consequences of which were not clear, from Saul to David to Solomon to the entrenched monarchy, to the split of that monarchy, and eventually to the eclipse and destruction of both branches of the monarchy, and a return to a decapitated society during the so-called exile or diaspora. It's often thought among those who share more or less my perspective that the monarchy put an end to the tribal system. That would hardly be true. Remember that this monarchy had very limited technological powers. What it could do, even in the relatively small area of ancient Israel, was highly limited, a great deal of resistance could continue because the people still lived in villages, still lived in their family and tribal connections, and were able to practice what James Scott, in his anthropological work, has called the weapons of the weak, the way in which the underdogs resist the power that they cannot wholly escape from. So this undertow from the earliest period continues on throughout the monarchy. And when you read the Hebrew Bible, it's full of some rather dire descriptions of the kingdom. There are two or three or four kings, maybe, who get some praise in the long list. And many, many, many of them are damned. We tend to read that as a religious damning. You know, they were idol worshippers or this or that. What is being expressed there? Yes, something about the religion, but also about the treatment of their subjects in accordance with the notion of religion that entailed respecting this more egalitarian, communitarian approach. The prophets, I think, are best understood as those who are have received the legacy of that tradition and who experience it in their own village communities, like Amos in Tekoa, Micah in Moreshet Gath, railing against the urban centers. Once again, it's not just countryside and city living, but it's the question of who has the power. Who has the power to determine what kind of life we're going to live in this village? Is it Yahweh who's at work? If it's Yahweh who's at work, then there are certain procedures and assumptions that belong to that kind of invocation of religious sanctions. The monarchy had to find a way to explain itself. And so it developed a counter-theology, the royal theology, in which Yahweh chooses the king of Israel as his agent, and even his adopted son. Today you are my son. Today I consecrate or adopt you, which instantly becomes a basis symbolically for Christian messianism, making of Jesus some kind of Davidic figure. So a struggle went on over, I would say, over who Yahweh is and what Yahweh asks of his people. There was then launched a struggle between communitarian and hierarchic understandings of God, society, economy, polity, religion, that went on throughout biblical history and beyond, and continues, I would say, to this very day. It is my judgment that the early communitarian life of Israel shaped the subsequent course of the Israelite and Jewish peoples in profound ways. For one thing, the communitarian life of early Israel lent strength to this later prophetic movement. It gave the basis for resisting the monarchy and the ostentatious greed of the client classes of big landowners and merchants. And perhaps it was able to answer the question that Max Weber asked in his famous book on ancient Judaism, but never fully answered, or I don't think gave a sufficient answer. He asked, how do we account for the survival of this pariah people? And by pariah, he meant nothing pejorative. He was thinking about Indian society and the pariah as a group set off, excluded in a way from the, excluding itself and being excluded, and yet at the same time surviving. And I think his answers kind of circle around the question. I think the central answer is these people began in a decapitated position. They started without authoritarian leadership, and in the diaspora they were returned to that condition. And that means that that whole undercurrent expressed through the prophets and sages and many of the priests then comes into its own. Now we got to do it. We've got no kings to tell us what to do. Thank God. But, what do you do if you don't have a king? And what do you do if you still have hostile powers amid whom you live? You've got to do something. And so Israel eventually works out the rabbinic Judaism. And that's when I, as a historian say, you should begin to talk about Jews then. not because what preceded was not Jewish, but because it wasn't yet fully formed. It hadn't come, you know, it was Israeli and so forth, but proto-Jewish, whatever you want to call it. And a remarkable achievement was made, which Christian scholars are still not fully grasping. And the early church for many centuries, continued in various ways the expression of that undertow. And even today, when you examine any particular denomination or congregation, you will find a spectrum of positions often reflecting these two understandings of religion. So, that being said, and there will be a question time, I know this strikes many people for the first time. You're not going to read about it in a whole lot of places. What about the other? What about the context for the other part of the analogy, the United States? Okay, its national identity was from the start a matter of functional individualism, a bourgeois society. Civil society is a collectivity of individuals in compact. Equal opportunity was available, but not equal access to resources. The notion of communal property, or even of entitlement of all citizenry in subservience to the general good, was never a part of the founding compact, about which the Tea Party people are right, even though there were large numbers of Americans who favored having that kind of a corporate sense. So it is one of the pathetic marks of a confused and uncritical theological calculation that it should think that early biblical Israelite tribal communitarian life offers any deep-going analogy for the founding framework of our nation. At most, it poses a great problem, a great historical and ethical problem, which is one of the good things about analogy. You start out with one that seems to work, suddenly it isn't working. Well, what does then work in its place? And that, I think, is because theopolitical language is so symbolic, indirect, and ambiguous that it is capable of extrapolation to support almost any position on the socioeconomic spectrum in relation to any given sector of struggle. So what we get often is lazy comparisons and false comforts. What we'd have to do, I would think, and I'm not saying no analogy works here, what we would then have to say is, in what way is the United States privileged or virtuous more than any other bourgeois state? Well, we can talk about territory, continental expanse, resources, technological progress, voluntary associationalism, certain procedures. You can name any number of specifics and mount a case, which may not be as strong as you thought at first, because I think in social services and education and health, we've slipped way down the ladder. But at least we have something empirical there, and we can say, okay, in this respect, the United States is a leader. And in this respect, I'm afraid not. So your analogy does break apart and is simply working now as the foundation for making some kind of comparisons. The American New Israel, which the Puritan folk thought they were, was never a tribal people, but rather expelled and exterminated the tribal societies that it encountered. And this is of course, one of the shocking parts of our history, but understandable, because it's the nature of centralized political order to gobble up and masticate other societies, traditional societies, which have trouble defending themselves. That's why the Jews had trouble defending themselves, and always have. And every minority people has trouble defending itself, because the power lies elsewhere. And the story goes on. We could say more about the diaspora Israel, which is a very interesting story in itself. Amid foreign denominations, social isolation, and religious persecution, they continued a form of self-rule with a lot of problems. There was always a struggle in those communities over the Jewish leadership, you know, trying to represent Jewish interests and also trying to please the foreign powers. And that was never a pleasant place to be in. And as far as Israel being any kind of an empire, the nearest that we would come to it is some notions of under Solomon, which are probably vastly inflated and never extended much beyond what would be today Israel and Lebanon, maybe Jordan. And then again in the Hasmonean period, a couple of centuries before the Christian era, after the Maccabean Wars, you had a spurt of empire there among the Hasmoneans who took on Greek names, you know, Alexander, Genius, and the like, who then tried to spread Jewish control over every place they could reach in that corridor between Egypt and the empires to the north. And they succeeded for, I think it's about 80 years, but then they fell to Rome. And in the midst of that, there was this constant battle between parties that later became known as Sadducees and Pharisees, the one party strongly defending this Jewish imperial thrust and the other party strongly resisting it. Now to the implications for us. By us, I mean the United States of America. To begin with, we would have to say, and here I want to speak about the empire. I have made some remarks about domestic United States. To begin with, the fundamental fallacy that starts it all off is comparing a superpower, the United States, with a minor kingdom in antiquity. And your unit of comparison, if you want to talk about socio-political scale, would be with relatively powerless countries. And I name a few here, especially those that have been kicked around a good bit by the American empire. Cuba, Nicaragua, Chile, Venezuela, Vietnam, Iraq, and one could mention a lot of others, who are basically defenseless toward superpowers. And so instead of the United States being the new Israel, if you're going to push your analogies hard, you'd have to talk about being the new Assyria or the new Babylonia or the new Rome. And of course, right away then you see that your analogy has to have more scrutiny. You know, there were lots of political processes not going on in Assyria, Babylonia, and Rome. So the analogy is certainly over the scale of power and the capacity to influence events and subordinate the interests of the rest of the world to the superpower. But within that similarity, there would be a lot of difference. And this is why there will be difference among interpreters of analogies. It's not sufficient to say what it is in your mind. You have to give an argument and expect a counter-argument, usually. Particularly ironic, I think, and I would like to emphasize this point, is the way in which the rise of early Israel parallels the situation of the Palestinians today. Early Israel arose precisely on the West Bank in that mountainous country, which was protected against invasion by the dominant powers. The population practices, as it did then, a very similar socioeconomic range of activities. You know, if you look at the olive orchards and the plowing with the donkeys and oxen and so forth, you know, you might as well be back in biblical times on points like that, the terraced hillsides, et cetera, et cetera. Similarities in social organization, the importance of family and of tribe, the difficulty of mounting kind of a unified perspective to the outside world when so much emphasis is local, and the existence amidst threats from surrounding states, one of which happens to bear the name from antiquity of Israel, and others of which are only moderately supportive. One could mention Jordan and even sometimes Egypt. In an isolated situation where it has to work hard on self-defense, and that self-defense has to be principally something that they manage to organize from within. Whether they have managed well, that's another question. So what we seem to see here then is that an ancient Israel arising in an anti-imperial situation becomes, through the reconstitution of the state of Israel, backed by the United States Empire, becomes something of the sort that it once opposed. So there's a kind of cycle there. The United States, which at least in terms of breaking away from England, wished to be anti-imperial, and I think one of our early presidents said, let's not get mixed up in foreign wars. We're different. Now, we too, now, coming around to a situation where you could write in the place of King George's name in the Declaration of Independence with a few changes, a number of things that the United States of America has done from which, I don't know, Puerto Rico, whatever, could declare independence. And that's a rather hard thing to get your mind around, but it's a central thing that in opposing certain developments, people with certain values and strategies for living tend to lose those when they face serious opposition and tend to become like what they opposed. Now, the counter-revolutionary answer is to that is don't try to change anything. Because if you try, you'll just be, that's of course unacceptable. Because there are enough instances, I think, of societies that have learned some lessons and moved forward. You know, you could South Africa, great as the problems are there. So it's not a counsel of despair, but it's a counsel of caution. And I'd like to close with a little more upbeat from a book by Richard Rubinstein, who is a professor of conflict resolution and public affairs at George Mason University, who wrote a book a bit out of his normal field, Thus Saith the Lord, the Revolutionary Moral Vision of Isaiah and Jeremiah. It's quite a nice book. And this is what he says in the introduction, I believe it is. It seemed natural to open the book of Isaiah again in the troubled months after September 11th, 2001, when America reeled under the impact of a catastrophe that seemed almost biblical in scope. I could see the terrorist assault provoking a violent American response, and that response provoking further retaliation in a potentially endless cycle of blows and counterblows. Perhaps the prophets would have something to teach us about how to escape this trap, and more generally, about how to live in a world so deeply and violently divided. Now, he doesn't tell us what they teach us, even what they teach him, although from reading his book, I think you'd get a sense of it. That process of what this past, which we often analogize, teaches us requires self-reflection individually and corporately. And that's not happening, I think, in the so-called beltway. It's not clear who's politically thinking, much less analogically thinking about history in the beltway. Outside, many people are thinking and are moved and swayed and have often very little to go on, and they tea party and they do this and they do that. They cite a Bible that many haven't read or have only heard presented in a twisted way. So civil society has apparently got to do now what politics isn't going to do. And how that happens, it beats me. But it's clear to me that it has to begin with self-reflection, knowledge of our history, and willingness to discourse, which now doesn't happen. Not even discourse about the debt, much less discourse about what America is, has been, wants to be, could be, and so forth. So I thank you for your patience.
Norman, that's terrific and very thought-provoking. We've had a lot of people talk about the Arab-Israeli situation. We've had politicians, we've had historians, we had foreign policy people. We've never had anybody here compare the Palestinians today to ancient Israelites or modern America today to Assyrians. So I think you've set an interesting standard. Now I'm going to, all right, I'll start with this question. It sounds like modern Israel is the new Rome of the region, and West Bank Palestinians are the new Israel. Does the remaining communitarian element in Israel recognize West Bank communitarian Palestinians as similar to them or as brothers?
Yes, many of them do. We talked about this some last night. There is more critical thinking on this issue in Israel than is evident in the United States. I mean, I think that has to be said. I just finished a book by Ira Sharkansky, an Israeli historian, and he has a whole section where he cites all many leading Israeli figures who have spoken out. They would have been muzzled in the United States a long time ago, I think. Yes, the answer is many Israelis do recognize their affinity. But, of course, I wouldn't make Israel the modern Rome. We're the Rome. Who was one of Rome's satellites? One of them, anyway.
Okay, here's another one. I understand that recent scholarship suggests that there were three major authors / editors / redactors of the Old Testament. Is that true? And when and who wrote the Old Testament? And you've got to limit yourself on this one.
This becomes a basic primer. Yes, there are probably three major strands in the Pentateuch, the first five books. And the period represented there spans probably from about 1,000 to about 500. And the final editing was between 600 and 400 BCE.
That was quick. All right. This one will give you food for thought. Who are the current U.S. prophets?
I often think about that. And one way to go at it is similarity of message, if you can identify it. And another way would be their social location in the community. And that's a lot less clear to me. In some ways, the most prophetic figure would have to be a populist who somehow came out of, out of rural America. I'm not sure what populism we have that's very articulate that hasn't been steered into the Tea Party movement. But I would say any figure who gets us thinking about the adequacy of our stance and prospect in the world and does it with any consistency without arguing that there is any infallible prophetic voice. They didn't consider themselves infallible either. They tried hard, and they were sometimes followed and often neglected. Okay, I'll go out on a limb. When I think about who I would pay attention to, I pay attention to Noam Chomsky.
That's radical enough. What is happening in the Protestant denominations? Are they understanding the kind of scholarship and thinking that you describe?
Some are and some aren't. That's the truth of it. Even among scholars, there's still a great division on this point of view. And the tragedy is that many churches and synagogues never hear about this. And I think one of the tasks to develop the civil discourse about this is for churches to get you know, get on their task. What are they supposed to be doing? You know, besides worshiping, they're supposed to be educating. So that definitely ought to be happening.
Okay, how about this? What in the current landscape, social, political, or economic, encourages self-reflection here in the United States?
My first thought was not much. For me, it's, you know, I guess it starts very personally. In other words, I happen to be one whose retirement has been affected by the downturn. So, you know, I'm not poor, and I'm maybe only middle or lower middle class. I don't know what middle class I am. But I know that money's harder to come by for me these days. So that takes self-reflection. How did this happen? Who's responsible for this? What can I personally do? And what do we need to do to link together? So I take it that we need to form communities of resistance, the committees of correspondence during the revolution. That of course, has been the kind of thing that has carried a lot of the political left in recent years. And even though we get disappointed at times, I don't see an alternative right now to carry on. That's the equivalent of the weapons of the weak, the resistance of the weapons of the weak. The computer is one of the weapons of the weak.
Give us your thoughts about the increasing, and the term that's used here is fractionalism of religion in today's world.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that it has increased. Its political edge has increased. There's been pushed a particular kind of understanding, not only of prosperity theology, you know, if you're a true believer, you'll basically get rich, but also this kind of, what I've in a way been talking about here, this kind of, I would call it pseudo-patriotism. Misplaced patriotism, I would say, misplaced on the assumption of some virtue or merit that was inherited rather than something that was performed and is performable and reformable. So I think it's just a little more severe, maybe quite a bit more severe than it used to be. But in my lifetime, I mean, I've never seen a time when there wasn't fractionalism. And there are some encouraging signs. You know, Protestants and Catholics at least talk now. When I went to seminary, we had a Catholic seminary across the road, and I never was inside of it, and nobody ever talked about it. And I did find out one thing, that this notion of the United States as the new Israel or people of God has not been a very Catholic notion. I had a class, and they were all Jesuit students, and they weren't cottoning to my description, and it turns out that they hadn't bought into the Puritan notion. You know, Catholicism represented something that transcended nations, but where the Catholics bought in was as immigrants when they needed to get attuned, you know, and to accommodate socially. But that in itself is an interesting thing. Just as one scholar in Canada once told me when I was lecturing on this, remember, we have never had a revolution in Canada.
Okay, let's get back to a religious question. What, in fact, were the religions of ancient Israel? And what the questioner asks is Yahwism, mm-hmm. Baal, female deities?
You know. Yeah, yes, yeah. It's pretty clear that among some sectors of ancient Israelites before the exile, there was a goddess. And we have some inscriptions which show that the Asherah of Yahweh, in two or three such inscriptions have been found. And, of course, that was something imposed by Yahwism. Something was gained by the monotheistic thrust, and something was lost, I think. And so the return of the feminine in Christianity and Judaism is very important. And whether one can just as well speak of God as she as he is kind of a litmus test of this. It's not been a problem for me ever since I first heard the idea, but it's a problem for many, and it has to be worked through. There were many other cults, and I think the basic one for peasants was a local form of Baalism to ensure fertility of the crops and human fertility, reproduction, and protection. And in my opinion, the way Yahwism went out was that it made stronger claims over those. Yahwism could give better crops, better reproduction, better self-defense, better self-order than the others. So I think it went out on a utilitarian basis, but it took a long time for that to happen, I think.
Okay, here's a question which sort of goes back to your initial introduction talking about analogies. How is a society or a country like the United States harmed by incorrectly applying historic or religious analogies?
By inordinate self-confidence in one's view of the world, to begin with, you know, misreading what's out there in the world because you have the superior wisdom, and then bad judgments based on it, wars that never should have been fought, for instance, misallocation of aid, and so forth, all under the notion that we will get a good outcome because we are virtuous. And I cringe at some of the things that even these liberal politicians say. I heard one of the MSNBC commentators say, endorsing Obama's notion that only in this country could he have become citizen, and blah, 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 blah. And he said, you couldn't do that in China. Nobody can just go to China and become it. And I thought, well, I better look into the situation of China. Certainly, I'm not Chinese. I'm not sure why I would, but I wonder if I could, you know, assumptions that certain things you can only do here without ever having examined whether that's true or not.
That's a positive note to end it on. It's been a terrific, it's a very enlightening talk, and it's approached the kind of things that we talk about from an entirely different perspective, and I really appreciate that, Norman. Many thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Now,